You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Well, good morning and welcome to the Eusebius McKayser Show with you until noon today. And my colleagues are chuckling. I was saying, I don't feel like doing radio today. But as soon as the mic goes on, though, then I just get so excited to have another chance to be in conversation with you. As we are every single weekday, Monday to Friday, 9 till noon. And, of course, we start the show with an open line, unscripted radio. You can tell me what you want to talk about right now. Give us a call on 011-883-0702, 011-883-0702. The other way you can set the agenda is on Twitter, hashtag 702 open line, and I can pick up some of your sentiments, some of the thoughts you have, arguments you want to raise and test out. Just about anything goes, but good luck if you don't have your ducks in a row, right? Because evidence matter and compelling argumentation always trump merely reporting what it is that you feel. What do we have in store for you? Well, after 10 o'clock, we've got you covered. Maybe you don't like detail, or you were just too busy. You couldn't read, or you didn't understand Paulie van Wyk's article about the links between VBS looting and Julius Malema. The latest article came out 2 days ago, and Scorpio investigative reporter Paulie van Wyk was all over the money trail, which is incredibly, incredibly important. But sometimes the minutiae can be very difficult to understand. So what is the link specifically between Mahuna Investments and the EFF and Julius Malema? We've got you covered. She's going to be joining me from 10 o'clock, and she's going to make you understand her methodology, how she goes about sifting through the evidence, and what the receipts and the paper trail actually do tell us. And the evidence matters. You know, when I look at Twitter, and I'm so delighted that I have a far more, I think, prudent relationship with Twitter. I don't spend much time there because life is too short, but I spend enough time there to be able to do justice to my journalism. And so I observe the way some of the EFF trolls respond to any commentator or reporter that reports about their leadership. My God, you guys are bored, eh? Firstly, don't you have any lives? The trolls, that is. I mean, how unproductive are you that you can spend like 20 hours with death threats, vile comments, all sorts of things, rape threats against women journalists. Really, really, really toxic. You perform the very toxicity that you deny is present in the leadership of the EFF. So you don't help the cause of your leadership in the EFF as supporters of the EFF. That's the one part. But the other thing is also, who gives a damn that you don't believe the evidence? I was thinking about it on my way to work this morning. I've got nothing to say to an EFF fan that is not interested in evidence. If evidence turns you off, don't even bother calling on my open line. Like, honestly, I can only engage you on any topic for that matter, whether it's death penalty, whether it's the economy, whether it is Jacob Zuma, whether it's Cyril Ramaphosa. I can only engage you if logic and evidence are things that you care about in argumentation. But if you don't care for facts and evidence, I really have got nothing to say to you. And I can see how some people respond to some of the investigative journalism with absolutely zero interest in the minutiae. So if you fall into that category, then you'll be best off listening to classical music for an hour. If you do care about facts and you do care about logic and probability and all the things that matter when it comes to reasoning rationally, make sure you tune in between 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock, and then you can judge for yourself. She might still fall short of your standards of argumentation. I'm not saying that the journalism is unanswerable, but what I am saying is I invite you to center evidence and facts in your evaluation of the case against Julius Malema, rather than just a gut sentiment or permanent love affair or permanent hatred for that matter as well. Then a very different conversation in the third and final hour of the show, which I really am looking forward to. If we have to leverage love as an emotion and think about black boys and how we raise them and interact with them, what are the implications for how we should go about raising black boys? And this is something I feel very passionate about. And the reason I do is that we pathologize black teenage boys and black men. We often, for the first time, see them as criminals at the point at which they've offended, and you find yourself as a black teenager in the dock because you are in a society that never even recognizes your innocence as a baby, as a black baby boy, as a child. And I think we've got to do better. I'm totally on board as we talk about gender-based violence with things like teaching all boys, black, white, brown, Indian, whatever, things like consent. I'm on board with the conversation. How do we get rid of toxic masculinity? All of those things. But I think in the long term, I was saying this to a friend of mine yesterday, in addition to doing the reactive work against the violence, we also need to talk positively about affirmation. You know what I mean? If you've got a black boy in your life, as a sister, as a mom, as a dad, as a teacher, what does it mean to take a value like love and centering love in your interaction with black boys in particular? And why do I say black boys? Obviously, that discussion generalizes to include girls and also boys of any color. But let's be honest, it's disproportionately black boys and black men that we end up being scared of. And to take a simple example, if a white boy does something that's antisocial as a kid, we are far more likely to say, oh, shame, man, he's just a child. Little Johnny's just a child. And that's why I make no apologies for racializing the conversation, because we don't extend the same assumption of innocence to black boys. It's almost as if black boys already come into our world from a social point of view pathologized. And so it is an explicit conversation around what would it mean to see the innocence in black boys, and what are the implications for how we raise black boys. So that's a beautiful conversation with a stunning panel. We've got Dr. Mampela Rampele, who since the 70s is a social worker and an academic, has taken a huge interest in what the implications are of the migrant labor system, racism, precisely for parenting, including for black women specifically that have to often raise black boys. And then I've also got my former Cape Talk colleague, Koketso Sichane, who's beautiful in thinking through parenting and in particular fatherhood. He's got a little baby boy now in his life. He's raising some girls in his life, but he now also has a baby boy. And then someone I've got an intellectual crush on, as you know, I keep saying it, Kopano Ratele. Professor Ratele is just absolutely brilliant, the author of Liberating Masculinities, and he specializes in men's studies, but he also takes a huge activist interest in the question, what would it mean to raise boys as a feminist father in particular. So watch out for that conversation in the third and final hour of the show. For the rest of this hour, it's over to you. 011-883-0702.
702. Open line.
Katlego, good morning.
Good morning, Sirius. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm awesome. I couldn't be greater. I just wanted to comment about this whole thing of our brothers and sisters being called foreign national. So I was watching the speech from our president, right? That he was addressing us last week, Thursday or so, maybe. And then he said something that actually just triggered something that people aren't really cognizant of. Every time he addresses people, he says foreign national. So I really think, in my honest opinion, that he's the one that actually perpetuates this whole situation of us calling people foreign nationals. I am myself half Malawian and half Sotho. So you can imagine that whole, you know, that contrast, and actually growing from growing up in that kind of system, in this society where people are viewed as, you know, foreign nationals and stuff, I was actually afraid of saying that my dad is actually Malawian. So that actually, it's something that actually South Africans should actually think of and see that we are all brothers and sisters. Whether you're Tosa, you're Sotho, you're Tswana, you're Venda, you're Tswana. The other day I was watching a Facebook video of this Shangani girl that was actually being beaten up, and it was actually so sad. And just because he couldn't speak Zulu, he couldn't say what an elbow is in Zulu, he was hit. And that just, for me, is really, it's such a disgrace to be South African right now. And I mean, if you look across all boards, if you go to another country as a South African, you'll never be viewed as a foreigner. You'll be viewed as a brother and a sister of the continent. You know what I mean? So it's really sad how we actually view these things as South Africans.
Thanks for that, Katlego. I hear you completely. And I think particularly what you say that for me is heartbreaking is how you suddenly have to self-censor in terms of articulating your own you know, your own background in terms of your parents and where they come from or where they were born and what your heritage is. We shouldn't be closing down the space for people to have a multiplicity of stories about who they truly are just because they fear for their safety if they were to tell the truth about their own origins. Gift, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Yusebius. Thank you very much for taking my call. Yusebius, there's something that bothers me about politicians. Now, they wreak havoc on systems in their country, like the health system, the economy, and they tell everyone that, like Robert Mugabe would tell Tony Blair to say, you keep your England, I'll keep my Zimbabwe, and we'll eat grass if we have to. In the meantime, his wife goes to shop in Dubai and overseas.
And Mandela Square. Sick,
yeah, and when they are sick, they come to South Africa, get special treatment, whilst people on the ground don't even have painkillers in the hospitals. And yet, even the African leaders allow it. I mean, maybe globally, the leadership also allows it, that people come and get special treatment in their country, while the people on the ground, the ones that put them in power, are the ones who are suffering. They are not even getting simple things like simple medication in hospitals. I don't know why we allow such a thing to happen.
Why do we?
Sorry?
What is your answer to your own question? It's a very important question.
No, I'm wondering, why do we?
I get you're wondering. I'm inviting you to reflect on your own question that you've posed. And I mean it very seriously. I think it's an incredibly important question about the relationship between citizens and political elite. Why do we, do you think?
Well, there is selfishness, obviously, that comes with politics. But I think countries should, this issue of sanctions, I used to think it was a bad thing. Now I'm beginning to think maybe it's a good thing. If other countries were to say, look, we will not allow you to go and get treatment elsewhere if your people in your country are suffering and you have created that environment yourself, you live in it. You cannot create a bad environment for your people and then go and live lavishly elsewhere or in our country for that matter.
Gift, thanks for your call. I really appreciate it. I want to, if I can, repurpose Gift's call and invite us to dig deeper into what he's asking. I think he's asked a pertinent question. He doesn't have an answer to his own question. That's perfectly okay. I think for me, it comes down to something I've raised on the show a couple of times before, but perhaps we can go there again. Maybe it will spark a new thought in one of you, which is to say, in the history of politics globally, there's a certain kind of contingent relationship between citizens and politicians. And I don't know why we accept it almost as a fact of nature that we must be deferential towards politicians that are useless AF and who screw us over. Why do we do that? Because that's the essence of his question, if we are blunt about it, right? One of the many clips about Bob doing the rounds is one where, after he was ousted, he had the audacity of lamenting a lack of democracy in his country when he described the process that led to his ousting. And I thought, without any sense of irony, the man doesn't even appreciate the hypocrisy that as a despot, he wants to critique the process by which he had exited the political stage in Zim. And that's the kind of hubris that politicians have when we allow them to have that kind of power over us unchecked for a very long time. And so for me, the essence of the question of the last call is precisely, why do we as citizens do that? And I don't have the answer either, other than the fact that we are habituated into believing that there's a certain kind of relationship that citizens must have with the state, with government, and with politicians as such. And you'll recall the example I've used before is something like the Blue Brigades. I mean, we just take it for granted that there's certain kinds of perks that must come with political office in South Africa. Why? There's nothing natural about politicians being revered, but we tend to do that. Why do we do that? I mean, give it a thought. Maybe you've got an insight that I don't have, that the last caller doesn't have. And unless we recalibrate that relationship between citizen and politician, I think we're going to be in enormous trouble. And it's not unique to South Africa, by the way. I think, for example, of how Boris Johnson is completely stuffing up parliamentary democracy by not respecting the sovereignty of his own parliament and even being prepared potentially to ignore a law that was enacted yesterday in terms of a no-deal Brexit not being allowed legally after Parliament showed him his comeuppance, right? And I thought to myself, here's a country that thinks it exports democracy around the world, a bit like the United States. And lo and behold, you have MPs who have to enact a law to try and get their own prime minister to actually respect the rule of law. What is it about that society that allows a Boris Johnson to be able to emerge as a prime minister? And many other such examples, both in Western Europe, in the African region and elsewhere. I think it's a global question about that relationship. There's almost like a sort of vertical structure rather than a flat horizontal one when it comes to the design of our politics, where at the top of that vertical structure you find political elite and near the bottom you find citizens. And that's something we need to topple, I think, and claw back the power so that we as citizens can have it. But the deeper, horrible, historical question across time and space is why, as citizens the world over, in many different societies, across various times of history, have we settled for that kind of relationship between politicians and citizens? Because clearly it doesn't serve any of us. 24 minutes after 9.
702. Open line.
Kiri, good morning.
Good morning, Eusebius. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for holding on.
Lovely. No problem at all. Firstly, I absolutely enjoy your show because it always prompts me to think very deeply about pressing issues and conditions that our country is going through.
Thank you, sir.
So absolutely amazing. So just a quick thing. We left this morning home and we stopped at a little school nearby where we live with my wife and myself. And we just went in just to drop off a couple of things, as we always do. But this call is about the kids. First of all, I haven't heard anything, call out to the listeners and to anybody that's listening in a position of authority. What is happening with the orphans and the AIDS orphans of South Africa? That's the first question. A solution to which I don't have, which is an open question. Secondly, the toilet issue. It's a very simple issue, but it's maybe one of the most important issues. And if you can just cross-reference it with gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. Very simply, the school has 300 learners from ages of 5 to 18. Okay, the toilets that were built about 2 years ago are very substandard. They aren't even enclosed. They're in an open field. And when we were speaking to the vice principal, she says we have a very acute problem, obviously, because there's no separation of male and female latrines. Also, for the females, for the young girls, to dispose of their sanitary pads, etc. So if you just cross-reference and look at that as a prerequisite for a young lady to have self-confidence, to just be self-empowered, I think a little thing like that makes a huge difference. And the millions that were squandered countrywide, and none of these systems have been put into place, maybe it's something that we need to look at and raise with the government.
Thank you, Kiri. Thank you for your compassion and thank you for thinking about those two very important issues, both toilets and sanitation and access to it in relation to the gender question specifically as well. And your first one around AIDS orphans. If that has sparked in any of you some thoughts, share them with us. What do you make of what Kiri has said? 011-883-0702. Igor, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Morning, Yubi. Not a first time caller. I've called in before. Thank you very much for taking my call. I want to talk specifically about the very subtle, very blatant message that our politicians of the South African government is sending. Mm-hmm. I take the example from the fact that our president very publicly has mentioned at the protest of our young women and children at the Cape Town International Convention Center, where they had the business conference, that he was going to go and visit the mother of the Cape Town, the UCD student that was raped and murdered in Cape Town. Firstly, this is a black lady, and it's a black student that was murdered. While at the same time, there was a grandfather and his young daughter that was murdered. There's no politician or president that's gone to go and visit them or convey their condolences. The Jehovah's lady that was the boxer who was shot by a police officer, a police officer boyfriend, a black boyfriend nonetheless, four times in the head and hurt her mother, an officer of the law who's supposed to serve and protect. There is no political presence at her funeral or visiting the mother's bedside. The question that I'm asking, and this for me is pertinent to where I come from as a colored South African, right? I'm a person of color, and I've seen us being ostracized economically from a different environment, especially in this particular instance. If you look at the area where we're staying, the same thing happens, where the transportation, the road that goes past our suburb called Eastridge, that's the only portion that doesn't have double lane traffic. Whereas the portion past Queenswood and Eastland, which is a predominantly old white suburb, has double lane traffic. The portion that goes past Mamulodi, who is a black suburb, has got double lane traffic. But the portion that goes past Eastridge is not. The same happens with the road that goes out of Eastridge. It carries most of the traffic out of Eastridge. However, we are still being marginalized economically. My question is, and I would like to put that out to the listeners, is what are we going to do as a people? Because we are still being victimized. We are still being sidelined. We are still being part of the oppressed. Because we, contrary to popular belief, we were not witnesses of apartheid. We were part of the oppressed. That is my comment, you see this.
Thanks, Ego. I'm going to put it out there. You've sparked a million and one thoughts for me, but I'm not an oracle. I am one of you, one of us in this 702 community. And so before I tell you what comes up for me as I listen to Ego's multiple set of thoughts, he started off by talking about selective political empathy being shown. And then that segued into a critique, particularly around the invisibility of colored victims and colored communities. Do you agree with him? And what if you're a politician listening to this show? Maybe you can answer Ego directly, right? Are you biased, even if inadvertently, in terms of who, as victims of violence, you show compassion for? 011-883-0702.
702. Open line.
29 minutes before 10 o'clock. Also with me on the open line is the DA national spokesperson and deputy federal chairperson, Rafilwe Mseka. Rafilwe, good morning. Thank you so much for being on 702 on our open line. I really appreciate it.
Good morning, your studios, and let me greet your listeners today.
I'm a bit shocked to be in conversation with the DA leader. You guys, I was wondering yesterday whether you still exist.
No, we definitely still exist. You see, there's a whole lot of things that we're still doing. But I think the main thing for us today is to talk about the violence that has plagued our country.
It is absolutely horrific, and it's one of those unrealities of our country where we have to galvanize across our differences, including political differences. Speak to me about that. How do you see the violence that's playing out? How would you characterize it as a Democratic Alliance? And what comes up for you, first and foremost, I think, as a citizen, actually, Rafilwe?
I think, let me start with not even my national title. So I'm a constituency head for Tembisa, and I don't know if you're aware that Tembisa is one of the affected areas.
Mm.
So when I sit in my house, I'm literally 5 kilometers from an informal settlement called Osimosi. Last week, Monday, my activists were we have a WhatsApp group where we communicate various issues. When you have activists saying we are being tear gassed, and I have to say to a mother with a child, please sleep under your bed, wet a big towel, put it over your head and the baby's towel to make sure that you don't get tear gas affecting your eyes and your nose so you're able to breathe and sleep under your bed. That is the pain that people are feeling on the ground. And I don't think people realize that this is not xenophobia. This is a big crime against humanity. Mm. We need to stand up, and I literally want to say to South Africans, whether you're South African or you're a foreign national, people are being affected. It's human lives that are at stake here. This thing has to stop. People have to come together and stop like you're saying, it's got nothing to do with politics. Today, I refuse to wear my political hat. I want to be a mom. Having to tell another mother to sleep under her bed with her child and put a towel over herself and her child over the face so that they can breathe. It cannot be right.
Mm.
Even if all the foreigners were to leave South Africa today, we are still affected. Yesterday alone, a child was shot because a Zimbabwean national's tech shop was attacked and people retaliated, and then the Zimbabwean gentleman shot back. These are lives being lost every day. These are people's lives being destroyed every day. What is happening is not right for South Africa. Foreign nationals, we need to stop fighting.
Mm.
South Africans, we need to stop fighting. We need to hold hands and realize what we need is our economy to grow, not be fighting each other.
Rafilwe, one of the challenges we have is, I think it's critically important that step one is moral condemnation. When looters behave criminally, by definition, that is unacceptable. We're trampling first and foremost on the South African rule of law, ironically enough, even before we talk about foreign nationals, although we can't pick and choose. So lawlessness is unacceptable and criminality is unacceptable. Once we've done that, we need to get a grip, as we tried to do on the show yesterday, need to get a grip on the drivers behind the violence. What are your reflections on what the drivers are?
I think the most painful thing for me is to walk in informal settlement and say that people are not working. I can go now, as we speak now, Eusebius. I can have a public meeting. I have 500 people on the ground. That is to show you how what people are grappling with in terms of unemployment. There are no jobs in the economy. And then when you see somebody with a spaza that is sort of generating an income, there's obviously, naturally, some sort of jealousness that comes through. But it is not right to attack that person, because whether you like it or not, even in that spaza, it may be owned by a foreign national, but the reality, he will probably employ one or two South Africans. So you've not only just destroyed that spaza for that foreign national, you've also destroyed jobs for two people.
I think that's an incredibly important point that you make. So the kind of toxic attitude towards that spaza shop owner, if he's not South African or she's not South African, I think you'd agree with me that it's unacceptable.
It is unacceptable. It doesn't matter who owns the spaza, Eusebius. What we need to say to South Africans and what I'm saying to South Africans is stop what you're doing. These are fellow human beings. You're thinking you're taking one person, but tomorrow you've left maybe a South African woman without a husband if you kill that person, or you've intimidated a fellow human being.
Mm.
We have to look at those things. You may be attacking what you perceive to be a foreign national spaza, but your sister or brother tomorrow is going to be without a job because that same spaza is employing them. So let us stop this thing.
I think that call that you're making for how we should view even spaza shop owners is absolutely on point. And I think that's good political leadership on your part. I want you to have a listen to this clip just very quickly.
I cannot afford a situation where I visit my family in Amanskral in Aramotsi, or I visit my family in Soweto. I go and buy bread from someone, I don't know who this person is.
What do you say to the DA Mayor Herman Mashaba, who doesn't want to go to a spaza shop, contrary to what you are saying, and he says, quote unquote, I do not know who this person is?
Look, I think it's unfortunate, but the reality is what we need to deal with is government must implement the laws of immigration.
Yeah, but hold on 1 second. Before we get to the ANC government, right, because they've been useless, but you presumably want to be the government in waiting. You want to be an alternative government. What do you make of Herman Mashaba's remarks right there in that clip?
Look, obviously we want to make sure that the economy is big enough for everybody to be in it. Of course I want to see South Africans owning spazas as well. But destroying spazas of foreign nationals does not mean you're going to build spazas of South Africans.
I get that. That's not my question. My question is, what do you make of Herman Mashaba's comments in the clip that I've just played for you?
Look, I think that the comment, I'm not sure where the mayor was coming from, because
you don't need to know. What he said was, when I go to Soweto these days, I don't even know the person that's serving me bread. He is explicitly there contradicting what you told me 4 minutes ago. And I think you are right. I think as a citizen, forget even being a broadcaster, I think you are right. That kind of attitude towards spaza shop owners is exactly what, you know, often lays the foundation for violence. He is saying there that these days when I go to Soweto, I can't even go and buy bread because I do not know this person that I'm buying bread from. What do you make of his comments?
I mean, let me answer you in this way, Eusebius. It doesn't matter when you don't know a person. The reality is it's a fellow human being. It's immaterial whether you know a person or don't. If you and I did not deal each other in the media space, you would have been a stranger, I would have been a stranger. But I'm a human being, you're a human being. And I think that is the premise we must operate from.
Then why must I take your... I mean, I take you seriously as an individual because I happen to share your analyses of how we should deal with this as a country. But I'm really, really deeply concerned when this is playing out in Joburg, which means that Premier David Makhura must be on top of his game. I'm not sure whether he is. And it also means that the mayor of the city must be on top of his game. He happens to be a DA mayor. Would you agree with me that there's a poverty of leadership when it comes to that kind of thinking from Mayor Herman Mashaba?
I think there's a poverty of leadership on a broader spectrum. We have challenges in this country which are being ignored. You know very well the economy is struggling. People are frustrated. On an emotional level, if you are struggling to provide for children and you're a South African, you look for an easy way out. And naturally, when you are a mayor of a city like Johannesburg, and the frustration is headed at you as the person that the people have voted in, you will do everything within your power to try and deal with the situation confronting your citizens.
Let me ask you bluntly. Would you agree with me that that clip that I've played shows is... There's no other way to put it. The comments there from Mayor Herman Mashaba are morally unacceptable. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Look, I can't say it's morally unacceptable when he says the person serving me is not somebody that I know. But what I do say is, at the end of the day, it's still a fellow human being. But what I'm
If you're not willing to condemn Herman Mayor Mashaba in that clip, then I'm afraid the first 2 minutes of your comment shows that you are just being a politician. If you are saying today I'm calling in not as a politician, and then you want to play verbal games with me after I play you a clip of someone who does the opposite of what you say we must do, then you are demonstrating that you yourself are ultimately a politician first.
No, Eusebius, I don't think you're...
Yes, because the simple answer is yes, Eusebius, Herman Mashaba was out of order, and you must show the integrity that your mayor is lacking.
But I don't have the context under which you said...
Why do you need context for a statement that is clear? I mean, the context defense, as you know, is BS when the language is plain. His plain language is he doesn't want to go to Soweto and be served by people that doesn't sound like him. What context is needed to be able to make sense of xenophobic sentiment?
I think the most important thing is that people must be documented in South Africa. If the people are not...
You are changing the subject, Wena. You are changing the subject. Come back to my question. Why are you scared to critique your own leadership? You know, yesterday I had a COSATU leader on the show. Despite being part of the alliance, COSATU was prepared to critique the ANC because it recognizes that it's important for us to be able, in this moment, to call out even weaknesses in your own alliances, in your own party. You started off on a very good footing in this discussion. Hold on, Rafilwe, I'm setting up the question. Rafilwe, we're not going to get anywhere talking at the same time. You know right now you're being a politician. That's okay. But I'm afraid you are undercutting the first 2-3 minutes of moral courage that you had shown by calling on South Africans to do better. Then I play you a clip of Herman Mashaba, and then you demonstrate that you want to obfuscate rather than to be clear that that kind of sentiment from the mayor is unacceptable. Why can't you be unambiguous?
I'm saying the statement by the mayor is unfortunate, and that was my opening line, Eusebius.
Yeah, unfortunate is like, it's not nice. I mean, it's worse than unfortunate. It stokes sentiment that leads potentially to violence.
But I don't, like I said to you, but I don't have context. It's a statement, just listening to it without the context of how, when the mayor said it and how he said it. Yes, I must be honest and say it's unfortunate. I cannot say...
Okay, hold on 1 second, Rafilwe. Let's play it again for you. Tell me whether... If someone has just joined the conversation, tell me whether Rafilwe needs context to be able to respond to this clip. Let's play it again.
I cannot afford a situation where I visit my family in Amanskral in Ramotsi, or I visit my family in Soweto. I go and buy bread from someone I don't know who this person is.
Usile Wena, Rafilwe. You need context to be able to condemn that. Hi, man.
But what's wrong with saying that the statement is unfortunate, Eusebius?
because it shows how pedestrian you are yourself in critiquing a leader that is an entire mayor, a whole mayor of Joburg.
Faced with a dilemma of foreign nationals taking over buildings, which he is trying to take back so that he can fix for the South African citizens to move closer to work.
I don't have a problem with what you're saying now, but yes. The shift, if I'm going to send you, I'm going to be nice and WhatsApp you the clip of our entire conversation. It is embarrassing how you are shifting from showing clear moral fortitude to now wanting to spin the mayor's remarks.
I'm not spinning, that's not my style, unfortunately.
Well, I'll leave it to the public to decide. Let me, for the next 30 seconds, take a vow of silence and give you a chance to give a final comment. Okay, it seems as if Rafilwe herself is choosing silence. 702.
Open Line.
Fana, good morning. Welcome to the Open Line.
Good morning, Eusebius. Eusebius, you know, I never wanted to congratulate you in my life, but today I will congratulate you for exposing the Democratic Alliance and its leaders, Eusebius. You had a lady who says she's got a constituency in Tembisa. She's a mom and everything. The lady could not criticize or condemn Mashaba for what Mashaba is doing, fueling the xenophobic attacks that are taking in the place.
Absolutely.
Where is Musi Maimane? Where is Musi Maimane? Because he was supposed to be on the ground also, but because of how the DA has been dealing with our African brothers, the CBS, in the city of Joburg and all over, it's a shame on the Democratic Alliance, the CBS, and they continue to expose these politicians who continue to make our people to fight amongst each other. And you know what has happened today, Eusebius, it has made me to say, never in my life will I ever vote for this political party. If leaders cannot criticize each other, then we're in a big, big, big problem. The lady could not answer a simple question.
You see, what happened there, Fana, is very plain, right? And I'm now 40 years old. I don't have time for nonsense anymore. And also, our country's issues are far more important than playing games. I think I've got a good sense of Rafilwe's character. Rafilwe is, unfortunately, a very good citizen, but an ineffective politician in the DA. She will agree with my viewpoint. I know that she does in her heart of hearts. But unfortunately, she doesn't have the ability to stand up publicly to a Afrophobic mayor because she might get into trouble with the party for doing so. But if you are the spokesperson, you need to have the skill to be able to make sure that you are consistent in what you said in the first 2 minutes of a conversation, and at the same time, to be able to find your way through a tough interview. And the bottom line is that the sentiment from Herman May and Mashaba contradicted flat out what she was saying about spaza shops.
Flat out.
I mean, there was no ambiguity there. There was an enormous opportunity there for a brilliant woman politician to show the men how to do things better in her own party and damn the consequences, because what we need to do as a matter of what is right, that should trump politicking. And if Herman Mashaba were to be annoyed with her after 10 o'clock, so be it.
You see, just imagine if this Herman Mashaba becomes the premier of this province or the president of the country.
Heaven help
us. What's going to happen? Heaven help us, Eusebius, that that man does not. And I just wish that man can be voted out in the office that he's having, because the DA is not even in control of that man called Herman Mashaba, the man who hates African brothers so much, so passionately that he even goes to say, I can't even go to a spaza shop in Soweto. We go to these spaza shops in Soweto, our grandmothers go and say, give me a bread, I'll pay you next week. They can't go to Mashaba and say, buy me a bread, Herman Mashaba. Shame on the Democratic Alliance. Shame on the Democratic Alliance and its leader, Musi Maimane. Thank you, my Eusebius.
Thank you, Fana. Kumbulani, good morning.
Morning. How are you and the listeners?
I'm good. I almost said Kumbulekaya instead of your name, Kumbulani.
All right. I just want to say that this Mashaba issue is basically something which people are overlooking, because yes, he's talking to us. Not only him also, but I also go back to the interview they had with Peggy Kelly. Peggy Kelly indicated that he is meeting the people who are rioting. And when he meet them, he informed the nation that he is going to meet Ian Duna of the hostels. And when he meet them, he said that they're going to be in Bizo on Sunday. And that, from there, something else came up basically on these issues, which really showed us where this is all coming from. Because Ian Duna has got their own bosses also, who instructs them. And that person is not being talked about.
And what is the answer to that? Because you obviously have a speculative view.
Basically, yes, I can say it's speculative, but no one has ever asked the role the king is playing in all because the Ian Duna are reporting to someone else. And that's why when they tried to meet Ian Duna, he was told, no, you're just a local person, you're just a nobody, you're not a king, so you can't call Ian Duna. That's why Buthelezi came and spoke to them. So there's something which is going on that we all don't know, but they are holding the whole country in ransom. And if they can just tell us what is going on and why they're doing this, it would be much better.
Okay, interesting take, Kumbulani. I think you're onto something. We're going to come back to some of that, by the way, in a couple of shows from now. Elvis, good morning.
Morning, how are you, my guys?
I'm good. Welcome back from the dead, Elvis.
Yes, nowhere. I'm alive now. You know, I've got a problem with South Africans here. When we have a problem, we see this is the problem, but we fail to solve the problem. What I'm saying is that we know there is this xenophobia. We know that people are killed every day. But what are we doing to solve this problem so that it must not happen again? Because actually the government is failing us. The government is failing in itself. Those people, they don't know, they don't have ideas of how to solve this problem. So why can't we solve this problem, we people, and then we say, this is the problem, let's stop the killing, let's do something, let's come with a solution so that these things must end. It's painful when you go to work and then you leave the kids at home, you don't know what will happen to them. And you are at work, you keep on calling and asking, are you well? Are you busy? Because this thing is going on each and every day. Who knows that one of the days it will end up that kids will be stopped to go to school and will be stopped to go to work. Why can't we find a solution? There's nothing, there's no need to point fingers at each other. Let's find a solution to end this killing once and for all.
Thanks, Elvis. Thanks so much for calling in. Much appreciated. Lusanda, good morning.
Good morning, Isidius. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you this morning?
I'm really well. I'm just so embarrassed by the interview I just listened with DA politician with Rafilwe. I am so appalled because at the beginning of her interview, it sounded like an isngala. Isngala is that thing in your throat when you're about to cry, when she was talking about the mother under the bed and then the spaza shop. And I really resonated with her as a mother. And she simply asked such a simple question. And she kept saying, look, look, look. And I was like, come on, girl, you can do this. Like, you're a woman. You are strong. You're a mother. You're so many things that you claim to be. And this guy really said something so obvious that he does not want to buy bread from. And what are people that you don't know? What is it that you don't know about these people? What is the difference between going to spa and a spaza shop that will give you this bread? Like, what in your head was okay about making a statement like that? And she couldn't say that I can't even believe that he said that.
And why exactly? And why do you need context? You know what I mean? The most ridiculous excuse, which is sometimes legit, but 9 times out of 10, it's an attempt to evade accountability, is context. What context do you need when language is plain?
It's almost like she was like, I'm so scared that I could. There's nothing to be scared of. If something is wrong, it is wrong. If something is right, it is right. If you say, you know what, I don't want to answer this because I'm scared, let's just take that on. But don't worm around the fact that you're a coward and the fact that you are lying.
actually probably doesn't even touch you as much. But like what you were saying, she is a politician, playing a politician role, and trying to get us to feel some type of way about the absence of the DA in, like, this whole time. And she was just, I'm just so embarrassed. More than anything, it was so embarrassing to listen to. I was in my car thinking, please, please, just say it was not right.
Absolutely. And if Ayman Mashaba feels touched on his studio, that's okay. We're going to have your back, because doing the right thing is far more important than upsetting Herman.
I mean, it would have been such a great moment if she stood up to it for her children and everything that she's trying to communicate to the 100%, other people.
100%.
It would have been such a great moment for her, but she just was like a coward, unfortunately. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Have a beautiful day.